Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast. I'm Pat Iyer, the host of this show. I started Legal Nurse Podcast in September of 2016 as a way to connect with legal nurse consultants, and that has been successful. We have listeners in over 105 countries around the world, and I'm excited to be able to bring you tips and knowledge about this specialized field. I would love to have your comments on the show, or compliments, or suggestions. Please go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com and look for a red button on the homepage where you can leave a message for me and share your comments. In this series of podcasts coming up next, I will be spending some time focusing on a skilled role for legal nurse consultants, that is, of being an expert witness. Arlene Klopatsky, who is a nurse attorney, and I have put together a course called Expert Witness Mastery for Nurses. It is beginning in the first week of May and will run for 4 weeks in May on Tuesday nights. And Arlene and I will be teaching you the skills that help you expand an expert witness practice. We're going to be giving you 4 live sessions that will include opportunities for interaction and to gain a deeper understanding of how to be a successful expert witness. This course is based in part on a book that I released this spring, 2024, called How to Be a Successful Nursing Expert Witness, Second Edition. Be sure to go to the link below this video, which is lnc.tips/expert-witness-course. You will receive the tips that you need to feel comfortable in this role and expand your caseload. If you see this video after the course has run, we will have the recordings that you'll be able to watch at your convenience. Now let's get on to the show. Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast. I am Pat Iyer, and today we're going to explore one of the issues that comes up in medical malpractice cases, which is, was this provider sufficiently credentialed and appropriately prepared for the responsibilities that they undertook in patient care? And that can be a sticky, tricky issue to get into. I have with me a physician who is an expert witness. He's an emergency department physician. He works with attorneys on nursing home cases, hospital administration cases, credentialing cases, and also criminal and forensic cases. And I'm sure you can think of criminal cases that end up with victims in the emergency department where some of those questions come up. Welcome to the show, and I have with me Vipul Kala.
Thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Let's get right into the concept that I started talking about earlier of credentialing and why it's used in healthcare. And also, as we talk, we recognize that most of our listeners are in the United States. We have a large number of listeners in other parts of the world who may have entirely different systems in place in order to deal with this question. Yeah. So first of all, credentialing, what's its purpose?
Yeah, so Pat, I think we can agree that overall, no matter what part of the country that you're in, hospital credentialing is primarily a patient safety issue. So it's a way for patients to know that the providers that they're taking care that are taking care of them, whether it's a physician or any type of clinical provider, as a nurse, a clinical, any clinician, has the adequate training and expertise, certifications, licensure, education, all of that background, and has the authority, the ability to take care of them. You know, so that's the overall theme. It's a way for patients and providers to have trust that the provider has adequate expertise to take care of them, and for the patient to know that I trust this, that I'm in good hands with this provider. So that's the overarching theme. Again, wherever you are in the world, I think we can all agree that that would be the main objective of credentialing. In the U.S. specifically, there's some additional areas that we look at. From a hospital standpoint, CMS requires CMS or Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services requires that providers be credentialed. It's also a requirement for any hospital that's looking for a Joint Commission or JCO accreditation, and which is most, if not all, hospitals are looking for that accreditation. So there's a regulatory aspect. And then, of course, there's a financial aspect. If you're a provider that's looking to bill insurance, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance, you have to be credentialed, right? So it's a way for providers and hospitals to make money and increase revenues. Now, I'll say that credentialing is not limited to hospitals. It could be in an urgent care setting, and it could be in any type of outpatient care setting. Or it could be in long-term care facilities and nursing home cases, and nursing home facilities. So that's important because many of the credentialing issues that I review as an expert are not only from a hospital to the hospital side, but they could have happen in the outpatient side as well.
That's a very helpful explanation, and it keeps the focus on the fact that we are wanting to identify practitioners who are competent, and the other side of that, to identify that 5% of the providers who are responsible for the majority of the errors, which brings me to another concept. Having been in healthcare as long as I have, and I've got the gray hair to prove it, I remember a time when it was possible for providers who had a bunch of lawsuits piling up against them to pick up their boxes and move to another state and open up practice. And no one in the new state had a clue that they had left behind a trail of poor outcomes, unhappy patients, or catastrophes. Tell us about the United States agency, which is the National Practitioner Data Bank, and what purpose that serves in this whole scheme of patient safety.
Yeah, well, you mentioned it already, Pat, but in the early 80s, you had instances where if there was a provider that was having a bad outcome, or any type of questionable clinical practice, they had the ability to move from state to state and from hospital facility to hospital facility and set up a new practice. And so this National Practitioner Data Bank was set up. It was the governmental agency set up by the Health and Human Services Department in the mid-80s. Basically designed to be this central data bank clearinghouse where all the providers' malpractice claims, adverse clinical actions, peer reviews, issues with any regulatory bodies would all be in this database, and it would function as kind of this flagging system, right? So it's this initial flag that can be used by credentialing bodies to see if there's any issues with the provider. Now, there's many other agencies and regulatory bodies where that have additional information. This is a very high level one that serves as a flagging system, and one in which most of us as providers don't really think about. But when you apply for credentials to a hospital, for example, they are required to access the National Practitioner Data Bank. And they're required to do that every 2 years. So that's a requirement for every hospital system. And that data is actually private. It's not available to the public. Hospitals and a few other healthcare entities can access this. But again, it's a high level flagging kind of alert system that credentialing bodies such as hospitals can use to identify providers that may have had some questionable practice or something that they need to look further into before granting privileges and credentials.
I can attest to the fact that it's private because I was involved in a case in looking at a credentialing file, and there were two reports from the National Practitioner Data Bank in this physician's file. The defense firm or whoever supplied the report had taken a piece of paper and taped it over all the relevant information that was on that piece of paper that described the lawsuits that this physician had been involved in. By doing some Google searches, however, it was possible to identify at least one of those two cases, and we have a suspicion about what the other one was about. So it wasn't a complete blank in information about this physician, but a clue to us that the facility had done their due diligence, got those reports. And then I think the question for you, Bipul, is what impact do those reports have? Is there a quantity of national practitioner data bank reports that should give a credentialing committee a pause, or is it the content of what that physician has been sued for that matters? Like, how does that fit into the credentialing decision?
Yeah, so I think the first thing I'll say is that we make a distinction between credentialing and privileging. And most of us don't think about them as two separate things, but you apply as to get credentialed with a hospital, you are also applying to get privileges in a hospital. Privileges means that you have specific abilities to, for example, admit a patient to the hospital, operating privileges, right? So if you want to be have the ability to perform a certain procedure or surgery in a hospital, you have to apply for privileges for that. That's important when we look at the National Practitioner Data Bank. So the first thing I'll say is that it has lots of different things in there. So there isn't a set number, that we use, when determining if somebody should get recredentialed or reprivileged. But the content is certainly important. So if there's a malpractice case in there in the National Practitioner Data Bank, you're able to delve further into what was the specifics of that case and what was the outcome. Because often, it may not be something, it may be a systems issue or somebody was named. It wasn't due to a practitioner error or a surgical error or a lack of a lack of expertise. There may be some other issue going on. And that's relevant when a hospital is considering whether to recredential. Then you look at things such as adverse clinical actions and peer reviews. What was the nature of those, and was there remediation? I think that's important to consider as well. I mean, was there any type of follow-up? Was there any type of additional education or training that was done? So it helps. It's a very high-level database, but I think it's upon the credentialing bodies, whether it's a hospital or whoever else, to take a deeper look in there and see what are the specifics with those actions. How significant were they to patient care? And then ultimately, what are they giving a provider credentials or privileges for, right? So if it's a very high risk and dangerous type of privilege that they're requesting, for example, neurosurgery or orthopedic surgery or interventional cardiology, something where there's a high risk of patient harm, that's certainly considered as well. So there's a lot of things in there. Obviously, it becomes very complicated, and it is becoming increasingly complicated because we have more licensure, more training, more regulatory bodies, more specialties even. More specialties are being added to the mix as well. That makes this whole process quite complex.
It is complex, and there are so many factors to consider. One thing that you mentioned that sparked my curiosity is the remediation piece. What would be the things that a legal nurse consultant might expect to find in writing if a provider was asked to go through remediation or was being supervised as a result of concerns about performance?
I mean, there's a few different examples. A common one that we see from a surgical perspective is, if somebody is, well, I'll start with somebody requesting privileges. If they're trying to do a new procedure, for example, there's some new laparoscopy or robotic surgery, for example, would be an example of in the past where it was something that was not done at all facilities. They would require a certain number of procedures to be done in an operative setting under supervision with some, with somebody there, and you have to check to check a checklist that a certain number would have to be done to be granted privileges. And that would, so that's kind of an example of what it would look like if you were trying to do a new procedure or get privileges for an operating procedure. If you had an adverse outcome, and now you're trying to request privileges again, then remediation could look like proctoring and having a certain number of procedures done under supervision in an operative setting. That's one piece of it. If it could also involve education, going to a training course, for example, a mini course, to receive formal education, it could require a certain number of CME, so medical education that's required, and a certain number of credits, whether it's through lectures or conferences, and that can be required. So we look at the nature of what's being requested, and if it's something that requires manual expertise, dexterity, precision, then that may require something like an actual in-person training. If it's something that's really specific to a lack of clinical oversight and a potential quality concern, then it can be directed more toward education and showing that you've completed a certain number of courses and CME requirements to show that you're able to take care of these types of patients in the future. So we really look comes down to what is the nature what is the nature of the request, and what would be the best type of remediation, education, certification for that.
Now, let me ask you one more question on this before we move on, which is, as an expert witness, would you expect to see that remediation plan documented in some form in the provider's file?
That's a very interesting question. It really is variable. And so there's a lot of human elements that come into play in the credentialing. And I wish I could say that it's a standardized process that happens in the same way in all parts of the country, but it's highly variable. We think about who sits on credentialing clinical executive committees. A lot of times these people have worked together for several decades, and they've formed longstanding friendships and have different types of relationships. And those relationships can sometimes compromise the degree to which hospitals recredential or look at some of these, how closely they look at some of these things. And that tends to show up sometimes in credentialing-based lawsuits and negligent hiring, where corners can be cut. Somebody who's been on staff for a long period of time, they keep getting pushed through the system. They may have had surgical outcome, multiple malpractice cases, yet they continue to get reprivileged and recredentialed. There's no remediation plan that's present. And again, there's other issues at hand as well. Political factors come into play. There's economic considerations, which we can discuss later, which unfortunately sometimes come into play. So there's unfortunately a lot of different issues that come in. It's certainly not a standardized process. Ultimately, it does come down to quality of ensuring that the patient's safe, that you're promoting high quality care, lowering risk to the patient as well as to the organization. But again, what we see and what I see as an expert is that there's a lot of variation in that process.
Well, thank you for that. That helps to clear up why there is so much variation, and all the factors that you mentioned can influence the process. Speaking of something else that can influence the process, we are flooded with headlines about AI and its use in all aspects of our lives. How does AI come into the credentialing process?
That's a great question. So I think if you think about what are some of the biggest administrative burdens that a hospital that a hospital may face, a lot of it is in the credentialing process. And having gone through it myself, and I'm sure you have as well, it can take several months, even with a spotless record, to get credentialed at a hospital. And it's also state dependent as well. California takes probably 6 months to get credentialed. And that's real for practitioners that really have no red flags. You have red flags, you can look at 9 months or even a year before you can get credentialed. And then you have privileges on top of that. So the process is very manual and highly inefficient. And what we see now, unfortunately, is that there's a lot of turnover in credentialing staff as well. So hospitals are now strapped because they have a lack of people to do the work. They're getting inundated with credentialing requests. And so that you're seeing like that new solutions need to happen. So what digital certification, AI certification does is automate a lot of these processes, right? So when you trying to do verification after somebody's applied for credentials, digital technologies can help speed that up, right? So they can speed that up, improve the verification, and also improve security, right? Because that's now cybersecurity is a huge issue as well. Data leaks are a huge concern as well. So it actually ensures the data is much more protected. So unfortunately, the majority of hospitals in this country today are still not automating this process. Like anything in healthcare, we're going to get there. It's just going to take a long time. But I think this is one of the real areas when we talk about, okay, where can we bring AI in healthcare? This is a potential area. And even more, there's also ideas of blockchain in credentialing. And by that, I mean, we think about blockchain in terms of cryptocurrency. It's the same application, same ideas for credentialing, where you have this decentralized ledger that's being kept at providers, and then it can't be changed. And that's a decentralized ledger that anybody can access, can't be changed, secure, and you're cutting out the middleman. So if we think about a potential where we're going, I think that that's eventually where we're going. How long it's going to take for that to be the standard for hospitals is probably a long time, but that's certainly a great area of a lot of entrepreneurs are looking at, a great area of business. So for anybody's out there that's thinking about starting a business and where there's a huge value, I would say to look at AI, digital health, and credentialing. I think there's a huge need.
And maybe that's the spot for all of the IT people who are being laid off left and right from some of the big companies.
Right, exactly.
Let me give you a scenario of a cardiac surgeon who storms into an operating room in his street clothes while his fellow is in the middle of replacing a heart and starts chastising this surgeon. He gets kicked off of the staff because of his behavior. Why is that such a remarkable decision, given that this hospital did a large volume of cardiac surgery?
Well, that's quite a case. I think that in this case, the number one thing that you mentioned is that, the nature of the case, right? This is an extremely dangerous surgery that requires, precision, concentration, and in an environment that's safe for patient care, right? So first and foremost, if somebody's doing something to compromise that, in creating an environment where there could be risk of a bad outcome, then that needs to be looked at specifically. So what we see is, in the case that you mentioned, the nature of the case, right? This is a highly risky, high prevalence of error type surgery, where you need to limit any potential factors, human factors, or any technical factors to lower that risk. So in this case, it certainly seems like an appropriate course of action. Perhaps also there was other instances as well, and typically there is other red flags when we look deeper. But again, it comes down to this is the type of case where it's potentially a huge risk to patients. And again, I have to look. We have to look at all sides of this from a hospital perspective. There's risk, right? There's risk in credentialing somebody that could potentially can pose harm. And so what I'll say about that is that. Hospitals typically in the past had employed all the physicians, right? So hospitals had what we call vicarious liability because they employed the physician. What we see now and today is that more than half of the providers, whether an ER physician like myself or any of the specialty, are independent contractors or IC, where they're not directly employed by the hospital, but they're granted privileges and credentials. In the past, ICs were kind of they were they didn't really have to face the vicarious liability. They were practicing independently, and hospitals could say, "This is not my employee. This was an independent contractor." They were kind of separated from that. But what we're seeing now with more Supreme Court cases passed is that ICs can also lead to vicarious a liability for hospitals if they come in, especially if the hospital is promoting them as part of their staff, as part of their hospital staff. And we've seen that in multiple cases over the past several years, where our hospitals now have vicarious liability, not only for their employees, but also for independent contractor physicians as well.
So many factors to consider when it comes to liability, to patient safety. And I know that we could talk for hours on this. We have just scratched the surface of this topic. I know that our listener who's watching this on our YouTube channel or listening on audio channels would like to know your contact information. If you could outline for us the kinds of cases that are in your wheelhouse for serving as an expert witness, that would be helpful. And then give us the best way to reach you.
Certainly. So I'm an emergency physician by background. So a lot of the expert work I do is involving emergency medicine. But I also spent a good part of my career in hospital administration. So I get retained on a lot of administrative matters, credentialing being one, policies, procedures, patient safety, joint commission standards, things like that. That's another part of my practice. I also have a particular area of experience in nursing home and long-term care facilities as well, policies, procedures, best practices. And then finally, a lot of criminal and forensic work. So physical assault, sexual assault, strangulation, those types of cases as well. So it's really a varied expert practice that I have, everything from emergency medicine, nursing home, hospital administration, and forensics. And a few areas that I'm looking at now, a few newer areas are in the digital health and telemedicine space too. So I start to review some areas now that we're starting to see some more litigation in those areas come to the fore as well.
Thank you. That is quite a varied background, and I'm sure it keeps you busy. I cannot imagine you saying, I'm bored and have nothing to do.
No, not at all. No, it definitely keeps it interesting, that's for sure.
What is the best way for people to contact you?
Yeah, sure. You can reach out to me by email. It's Dr. Kayla, DrKellA, at medlegaladvisors.com. You can find me on LinkedIn and reach out directly. My website is medlegaladvisors.com as well. So feel free to reach out and happy to discuss any potential cases.
Wonderful. And if you would give your email address again and spell it just to make sure
Yeah.
that people who are listening to this have the correct spelling, that would be helpful.
Absolutely. Dr. Kayla, DrKellA, at MedLegalAdvisors, MedLegalAdvisors.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Kayla. This has been enlightening and fascinating, particularly when we think about the complexity of healthcare and so many things that have to go right in order for the patient to get the appropriate outcome and all the things that can go wrong. I sometimes envision the healthcare system like this box, and under the box is a safety net. And the safety net has got holes in it that you don't even know exist. Until something happens, like that Swiss cheese model to show how all the holes line up, and the patient is the unfortunate arrow that goes through all of those holes to the bad outcome. So, we certainly appreciate the work that you do and the focus that you have. It's so critical for patient safety.
Thank you, Pat. Very well said. I agree.
Thank you. And for you who's been part of this program, be sure to go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. Sign up to receive the transcripts of these programs. We record every program, as you know, and also get it transcribed and make those transcripts available at no charge to you as our listener. Hang on for a few more minutes to meet the guest for the next program that's coming up next week. Thanks so much. Coming up next on Legal Nurse Podcast, I'll share with you tips on how you can get your invoices paid, how you can arrange for increasing your rate, and how you can keep your clients happy and coming back with more work. Coming up next, how to manage your invoicing process. Thank you for watching this episode of Legal Nurse Podcast. Be sure to go to the link below this video, which is lnc.tips/expert-witness-course. You'll get the information that you need to sign up for our live expert witness course taking place during the month of May 2024, every week for 4 weeks in the evening in Eastern Time, to get the skills, the knowledge, the support that you need to expand your practice as a nursing expert witness. I would love to see you in the course.